Excellent, Bradley. Welcome to your committee. I know we're all getting info up there, but if we could hold it down a little bit so we can hear up here, I'd appreciate it. Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, to get the business started, I would move House File 3697 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Bradley moves that House File 3697 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Bradley?
Mr. Chair, I would move to amend House File 3697 with the AO6-1487, which is the delete all that this committee has reviewed and had testimony on.
Representative Bradley moves the AO6-1487 delete all amendment. Representative Bradley, to that.
Mr. Chair, that just gets the bill in the form that we will then begin our committee action.
Okay, great. Members, we will take a vote on that. A vote on that, then. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Bradley, to your bill has amended.
Sure. I think that we ought to move right into amendments. We've had review. We've had public testimony. I would like to move the A32 amendment.
All right. Representative Bradley, should we go to your A32 amendment?
Right, Mr. Chair. To just quickly review that with members, I would consider this an author's amendment to get it in the form that we've discussed today, but I do think that I owe members kind of a quick walkthrough. On line 1.3 of the A32 amendment is deleting a section on the emergency room language. It's been learned subsequent to our presentation that section, which was thought originally to be part of matching up with DEFRA, is not necessary. So this revert us to the language as we passed last year in committee. Then the line 1.5 to 1.7 is contingency language on the MCHA reduction, the MCHA assessment reduction. We need this, so this has to do with the health impact, the contingency. Then from line 1.8 into the next page, there were four Representative Aber provisions that were accidentally missed in the delete all amendments, so we're just adding those, and that would be the reduced payment amounts permitted, the provisions for information and pharmaceutical assistance program, the prior authorizations on page 1, and then on page 2, line 2.3 is the use of evidence-based standards, so that would just bring those back in as they should have been in the first place, so that's just for correction. On line 2.8 just clarifies the intent of the study. There was language in there about universal participation and the title that had nothing to do with the actual content of that portion of the amendment. On line 2.11 on are a number of corrections, technical corrections to the appropriations language into page 3. On page 3, line 10, is a deleting the section. This has to do with healthcare access transfer language from the governor's bill that we actually don't need. And then on line 11 is just putting in the amount of money that comes from the tobacco endowment fee that is closed out. And Mr. Chair, that's the office amendment.
Thank you, Representative Bradley. Members, any questions to that amendment? Seeing no questions, we'll proceed to vote on the A32 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, then I would like to move the AO6-1520 amendment.
Representative Bradley moves the AO6-1520 amendment. Representative Bradley to that amendment.
And I mentioned this briefly to Representative Huntley. Members, this is an issue which has been under some discussion, considerable discussion, the last several days. What the amendment would do would be to delete the entire section or sections that regard dehydration and nutrition from the bill. That's one part of the amendment. And then the other part of the amendment would spend the money that had been set aside for that for a facility rate increase in Otter Tail County. I think it's for Battle Lake Nursing Home that's in particularly bad trouble. And then it would accommodate Representative Finstad, work that you and some others have done with the advocate community in county-based purchasing and I think in some reporting language. And Representative Finstad, I believe you had an oral amendment that you wanted to have for that. You have that identified?
Yes, Representative Bradley. Page 1, line 26, if we could, after B, insert aggregate. If you could incorporate that,
Representative. I'm sorry, Representative, what was the change again?
Just insert page 1, line 26, after B, insert aggregate. So it would read aggregate non-personally identifiable health plan and counter data. And I believe this is to the AO6 1520 amendment.
So before non-personally, there would be the word aggregate then.
That's correct, Representative Bradley. And I believe that the all the groups that have worked on this have signed off, and they believe this is the way to go.
And there being that agreement, I would just incorporate that in my amendment.
All right, Representative Bradley will incorporate that. Representative Bradley, any further comment on...
No, I hope I've explained it so people understand. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to respond to those. This is a fairly significant amendment, but I think it's quite clear in its content.
Members, any questions on the AO6 1520 amendment? See no questions. We'll proceed to vote on that. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted.
Then, Mr. Chair, I would like to move the A24 amendment.
Representative Bradley moves the A24 amendment. Representative Bradley for that amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it may be useful to have a representative of the coalition that put together the assisted living recommendation to us. So we have been struggling for some time on the correct language for funding. And we have had sort of the technical advice. I think maybe Ms. Zimmerman can explain, because I think this now embodies what we believe is sort of technically correct. And if I can add my lay start, and then Ms. Zimmerman can correct me if I've got it wrong, we have to sort of keep in mind that the way we currently operate, the second year of the biennium automatically becomes the base for the next year, unless otherwise said. And that would have said that essentially the $140,000, if you remember, in our current biennium, we're using a special revenue funds. In the next biennium, it's proposed to use an assessment that would be assessed against the assisted living facilities. And there's been some concern about the size of that. I think a lot of us, of course, in this body are concerned that our own constituents who are operating particularly smaller facilities might discover that they're having a fairly significant increase in their assessment. The assessment that they're getting currently as a housing or services facility might change. So I believe if Ms. Zimmerman could take just a moment and kind of explain the technical correctness, particularly I think that line 8 to 9 of it has to do with going to the next biennium.
Zimmerman?
Mr. Chair and members, line 1.3, the delete sliding scale and insert surcharge, that's just a technical correction. I believe the language says to cover the projected cost, we need to have it be the surcharge and not the sliding scale. The sliding scale is just how it's allocated by the size of the facility, not the actual amount of the surcharge that's collected. And lines 1.4 through 1.6 kind of go together. We had in the bill that the commissioner would annually adjust, and this would kind of put it in line how they do all the other fees, where they would come every 2 years and present the fees to the legislature that way. And then lines 1.8 and 1.9 is just saying what the base will be for 2008 and 2009, which is increased by 140, so it's 280 per year.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you,
Chair.
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, I do think it would be helpful to have a representative speak, and I would just sort of preface it with what I've requested. I've requested that there be full disclosure to those that would be impacted as to what the projected. Now, nobody knows exactly. You can only put in the best estimate we have currently, but if you take that, I think it's only fair to the potential assisted living facilities to have an understanding of what they would be facing, and then to assure this body, and for the record at least today, to have some assurance to those of us sitting here making this decision that that this is a supported approach. We had some discussion before. This is keep maturing, but I'd appreciate a comment on that.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lori Meyer. I'm with the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance, representing the Long-Term Care Imperative and the Stakeholder Group on Assisted Living. And I appreciate Representative Bradley's comments about some of the concern that was raised after an analysis was done of the surcharge and potentially how high it could go based on some of the projections by the Department of Health. I appreciate that sensitivity, and it is, in fact, an idea that came from the provider community to use a surcharge or fee mechanism to support the enforcement provisions of this bill, as long as we are sensitive to how high those amounts could go. And while I'm not, I don't have a copy of the citation and the amendment and how those fees would be set, it would be our hope that they would be based on the actual experience of injunctive relief that occurs in the first 6 months of the implementation of this legislation, and not based on the fiscal note that you have seen during this discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bradley.
I have no further comments unless there's other people who have questions on the A24 proceeded to vote on.
Thank you. Ms. Meyer, quick question, just clarifying for the record. Now, it's my understanding, I just want to make this clear, that this is something that the Long-Term Care Imperative brought to the legislature. You, as a group, or groups, worked together on the fee structure and brought that to us for the proposal. And I guess just for the record, and to squelch any political rhetoric that might be out there, I mean, it's a fee that the industry itself said we want or we need to protect X, Y, and Z as far as the remainder of the provisions in the bill. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, unfortunately, as most things, it's not as crystal clear as that. Certainly in the discussions as the enforcement provisions and the need for a funding mechanism have evolved very quickly over the last few weeks, there were essentially two options available to us. One was a survey and enforcement fee-based approach that clearly our members did not support in either of the provider associations. An alternative was then raised by our members, and that was to assess a reasonable increase in the fee structure. Just by way of background, the Housing and Services Registration Fee is $35 and has been $35 ever since the Contract Act was put in place 10 years ago. So our members did say a reasonable adjustment, excuse me, to that fee would be something they would support. Obviously, there is a point at which that fee increase gets so large that some of the smaller providers and others may have concerns with it. I can't say that you all won't get phone calls from some of those providers, regardless of what fee amount is enacted. But from the leadership of the two associations, we do support a reasonable fee increase. Sorry, I can't be more precise.
Ms. Meyer, what we have in front of us, in your opinion, is it reasonable?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe Representative Bradley said that this is maturing. I would hope that with additional time to look at the language and see how the citation in particularly would instruct the creation and setting of the fees, it does seem reasonable in my opinion.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. You remember I have to go home at night, so. Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, just for as full disclosure as we can have, because this is approximate, the language does call for a sort of a sliding fee based on the size, because we're sensitive to smaller facilities, of course. But if you took the worst case, the estimate that we currently have in our fiscal note of a $280,000 a year, that could result in somewhere around $700 as being the assessment or the fee to the to a site. So I personally think that we are in some respects at risk. Now, if the coalition is correct and the experience is not as many injunctive relief actions, then obviously that would get scaled back.
Ms. Meyer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Valley, we appreciate all of the work that you have done in bringing this forward. And I have to say on behalf of the long-term care providers and our membership and in care providers, we absolutely believe that our providers will comply with this legislation. It's in the best interest of the consumers and the provider community. And based on that knowledge of our membership, I don't believe the Department of Health's fiscal note is accurate. And if the need for court action is in fact very low, I don't believe we'll see the fee increases that otherwise might occur.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Members, any questions on the 824 amendment?
Thank you.
Seeing no questions, no discussion, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of the 824 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, if I can ask, I believe Ms. Zimmerman has an oral amendment for us on page 114.
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair and members, on page 114, delete lines 10 through 15.
Mr. Chair, I'll make that motion to amend.
Representative Bradley moves the oral amendment to delete. Give me
line,
one more time.
Page 114, lines 10 through 15. 15.
All right, thank you. Representative Bradley moves the oral amendment to delete lines 10 through 15 on page 114. Members, any discussion to that oral amendment?
What are we doing?
Representative Bradley.
Zimmerman?
Mr. Chair and members, we're just deleting duplicative appropriation language that we inserted a boilerplate for in the author's amendment.
All right, members, any discussion on that oral amendment? Seeing no discussion, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Bradley.
Chair and members, I would move the A29 amendment.
Representative Bradley moves the A29 amendment. Representative Bradley, to your amendment.
Mr. Chair, this is part of the provider cost disclosure and I believe represents some agreements with the pharmacies in the first subdivision 2 toward the bottom. And on page 2 at the top, health plans are a little bit concerned about in our language that says you can have a designee that the designee has to agree to it, which is probably only fair. And then in the case of provider, of course, from a health plan's point of view, what they have control on is the providers that are within their network. And I think the other is just establishing a specific effective date as opposed to after date of enactment.
Members, any discussion or questions on the A29 amendment? Discussion or questions? Seeing none, we'll proceed to vote on the A29 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, I would move now the A37-1 amendment.
Representative Bradley moves the A37-1 amendment. Representative Bradley to that amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I will admit that this is a little late. When we have hearings, I listen pretty carefully to the testimony, and there's a lot of things that I wish I could do in addition to what we have, but there's one to me that's particularly compelling that I think is at least a partial solution. We heard from the area agencies on aging about the workload they have as they're trying to help people on the Medicare Part D. It struck me as I listened to it that there really is, particularly on a short term, and I can't find the money to do it long term. But what this proposal would do would be to give the 2007, the governor had 2006, I think it was about $500,000, then had money allocated in 2007 to those area agencies for help with Medicare Part D from the Health Care Access Fund. I think you all know that I'm sort of a hawk on what comes from the Health Care Access Fund, but I don't feel a whole lot of choice, and I turn to the committee and would ask for support. I think this is a worthy enough cause. It would be a 1 year only. We would allocate $1.25 million to those area agencies. It would be up to the 2007 legislature to decide how this might be continued. My hope would be that it would be general fund actually and continuing. But I, in listening to the testimony last night, I thought that this was something that we need to do. So I would bring that to the committee.
Members, any questions or discussion on the 837-1 amendment?
And, Mr. Chair, if I may comment, too, we did check the balance in the Health Care Access Fund because we're trying to make sure it's protected. We are still protected. Now, you have to understand rollover. It's what's shown, and Ms. Zimmerman might be able to tell us what the balances would be at the end of the current biennium and then in 2008 and 2009, just to make sure members are aware that we've been mindful of that responsibility, too.
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair and members, if you look at the Health Care Access Fund balance on line 64 is the bottom line. Right now it shows $11.799 million. That would change to $10,534. And in fiscal 08, the next year, the current balance is shown as $1.5 million. That goes down to $205,000. And in fiscal 09, the current balance shown is $3.018 million, and it goes down to $1.683.
Thank you. Members, any questions? President Walker.
Last question, Mr. Chair, and thank you. It's just a comment. Representative Bradley, I thank you for listening so tentative last night. I wish I could have been here. Actually, I would have rather been here instead of where I was and waving me. It would have been more educational. But I'm going to vote, actually, against the amendment. My difficulty is just the place that it's coming from. I believe that the senior linkage line is important. I understand that the funding difficulties that they're having, and as we have more individuals aging and the importance of getting accurate information, and especially as it relates to Medicare Part D, I said in this committee earlier, you know, I'm still struggling to sign my mother up, and I'm not a... unintelligent person, but the difficulties with some of these forms, I do understand that our seniors need help. I'm just going to have to pass and vote no, unfortunately, on this amendment.
Members, any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, we'll proceed to vote on the 837-1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
The amendment is adopted. Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, I think now I would suggest we move to the A26, which is a Wilkin amendment.
All right. Representative Wilkin.
I'll move the A26.
Representative Wilkin moves the A26 amendment. Representative Wilkin to that amendment.
Mr. Chairman, members, this is has to do with DEFRA and the way it's handling the language in the bill is handling annuities. Basically, annuity issuers... and the current bill would not be able to settle a claim without getting a statement from DHS. There's no time frame to get that from DHS, and so the other beneficiaries of the annuity would be basically waiting indefinitely. So DHS, the Department of Commerce, and the annuity issuers got together and agreed on this amendment, and this fixes all the issues involved.
Thank you, Representative Wilkin. I see Mr. Chun has his hand up.
And Mr. Chair, members, I've also been informed by agency staff that a technical correction to the amendment is needed on line 19. The reference to Subdivision 3 should instead be Subdivision 4.
Mr. Chairman, I'll incorporate that into my amendment.
Representative Wilkin incorporates the change. Members, line 19, scratch the Subdivision 3 and insert Subdivision 4. All right, members, any questions on the A26 amendment? Representative Goodwin.
Okay, I'm not fully understanding this one. Tell me, Representative Wilkin, if you're saying that the surviving spouse will have to pay that out of an annuity, out of their annuity, or how is this transfer?
Representative Wilkin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, my understanding is the DHS actually, through the whatever they have already have a claim on that annuity, so both the surviving spouse and DHS might be getting a portion of it. It's just under the current language, the annuity issuer cannot distribute the portion to the spouse until they hear from DHS what their cut is. If I'm not explaining that with enough clarity, maybe someone from the department can explain it further, but this basically speeds things up at DHS so that the surviving spouse can get their cut, and now someone can come and correct everything I just said.
Representative Bradley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it would be helpful to have a comment from the department. This is kind of a tricky area because we're talking about compliance with the federal deficit reduction. And my understanding was that this is sort of a kind of a correction to it. It still maintains compliance. And if we could have confirmation of that, I'd appreciate it.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kim Carlin from Department of Human Services. This provision of DEFRA requires that people designate the department as a beneficiary to annuity in certain circumstances. They are either annuity in the first position or second position if there is a surviving spouse or surviving dependent children. When, at the time of the estate or when a payment becomes due on the annuity, then this language just directs the department to respond with the amount of medical assistance that's been paid on behalf of the annuitant within 45 days.
Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so currently, so this would say that they have to designate the department as well, or is that already in current law?
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, this has come out of the Deficit Reduction Act. It is a new requirement for persons who are applying for medical assistance payment of long-term care services. You have to designate the department or the state as a beneficiary to certain annuities.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. What kind of annuities?
Ms. Carlin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, any annuity... Think of any annuity that they or their spouse has an interest in.
So, Mr. Chair, that would be pensions. That could be pensions, retirement funds, investments. It could be all of those things.
Ms. Cohen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin. Yes, any annuities.
So,
Representative
Goodwin. So we're going to be leaving the spouse, or we already are, if some of this is in place now, with a partial retirement or whatever, so they're going to have less money to live on. Is that correct?
Ms. Fallon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, no. When there is a surviving spouse or dependent children, they are the first beneficiaries. So it would only be when there is no surviving spouse or dependent children.
But
Representative Goodwin.
I've got a lot of questions on this. So, Mr. Chair, and okay. So, but what if there? Okay, what if if the surviving spouse is the first beneficiary and the state is the second beneficiary? That's the way it is if there's a surviving spouse or children, correct?
Ms. Carlin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, this language in this amendment only has to do with procedures on how the department has to respond when notified by an issuer that payment is due. The rules around this, we're still, you know, the guidance from the federal government. I can send you, you know, the federal language, but as we understand it, when they designate us as a beneficiary, we would be paid after community spouses or dependent children.
Mr. Chair,
when there is no community spouse or dependent child, then the department.
When we designate you as a beneficiary, and how does that happen? Just when they apply for medical assistance or when they need medical assistance, then they have to designate the department as a beneficiary, correct?
Ms. Cohen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, when someone comes in and applies for medical assistance or they're requesting payment of long-term care services. At that point, they sign, and it's in the language, they would sign a disclosure form. DEFRA requires that they disclose any interest they or their spouse have in an annuity. Then we would send that notice, that disclosure notice, to the issuer of the annuity, letting them know of the state's right as a beneficiary. The issuer is required to notify the county agency of any withdrawals from the annuity so that the county agency can determine what effect that has on eligibility. And then at the time the annuity becomes payable, they would notify the state if the state is eligible for payment.
Well, I'm just wondering how this is, I still don't quite get it. If the second beneficiary is the state, at what point does the state get part of the annuity? Do they get part of the annuity immediately if they're the first beneficiary? But if they're the second beneficiary, when then do they get part of the annuity?
Ms. Collins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, I believe, and I'm not the annuity expert, but I believe how this works is if there's a spouse or a dependent child, at the time they sign the disclosure, the state is the second beneficiary. At the time the annuity is paid, if there's no longer a spouse or dependent children, then the state would be paid.
But, Mr. Chair, that's a good question. If the state is the second beneficiary, are they still entitled to any part of the annuity while the surviving spouse is alive?
Ms. Carlin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, I believe not. I believe the answer is no. The state is only receives payment from the annuity when there is no spouse or dependent children.
And one final question, Mr. Chair. So then the state is automatically the first beneficiary when there isn't a surviving spouse and children and or children?
Ms. Collins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, that's correct.
Representative Ochamba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sometimes spouses each have their own annuities. So can the state put, I'm going to say lien, on the surviving spouse also?
Ms. Carlin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bertrandba, I can confirm this. I believe that we would only have for purposes of recovery of medical assistance that was paid to the person receiving the long-term care services, we would have a beneficial interest in an annuity of that person or the surviving spouse or the spouse.
That's the much ever.
So, Mr. Chair, then do you advise them a divorce? I'm serious. This is what's going on.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ochamba, this is the federal law. I don't have an advisement. I can get you more information, and as we receive more guidance from CMS, I'd be happy to pass that on as to how this specifically will work.
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe we've kind of talked about this a little bit, and we've been really busy, but I think a good, solid overview of the federal laws that are coming down on us, that we should have some time to, in detail, see what they really do say. It's hard for me to know. I've skimmed through some of it. Obviously, you don't know it all either, and I just think it would be a great thing for us to, I'm having a hard time arguing this or even talking about it because I don't know all the details, and you don't know all the details, and so it's hard for me to say yes or no to this when I don't really know what the feds are saying, so thank you.
Representative Wilkins.
Mr. Chairman, so Representatives Ochamba and Goodwin, the amendment really doesn't, I know you have concerns in that area, but that's basically the bill is complying with federal law. This amendment doesn't really have anything to do with your concerns, just so you know. This just makes the structure work so that basically the surviving children or family members get what they have coming to them.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Chairman.
I trust you, Tim. I don't always trust the information that I've got in the past on these types of issues, and that's why I'm asking all these questions, because We've been burned before.
Representative Goodwin.
Final question. I keep saying that, I guess, but at least in this. Are we obligated to pick up all the federal language in DEFRA? And are we, can a state deviate from that federal language at all?
Ms. Carlin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, my understanding is that to the extent that we don't comply with the federal language, we would be at risk of losing the financial participation on the long-term care services that we paid.
And Mr. Chair, how much, that's not the last question. How much is that we get from the feds for long-term care?
Ms. Carlin.
Mr. Chair, members, it's approximately $1 billion a year.
$1 million?
Billion.
Oh, $1 billion. That's a few dollars.
All right, members, any further questions on the A26 amendment? Seeing no further questions, we'll proceed to vote on Wilkin A26 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. We'll go on to the 828 amendment. Representative Emmer?
I've moved the 828 amendment.
Representative Emmer moves the 828 amendment. Representative Emmer, to that amendment.
Members, if you go to page 93, this amendment would address the following, and this is the pharmacist conscience clause, some have referred to it as. And I'll just preface it with there were some significant changes made to the language in the Senate version that passed, I believe, last week. In response to that, as I don't necessarily agree with all of those, and because the interested parties would like to continue to discuss the issue, I'm proposing the following amendments to the language. First, at line 93.26, after the word device, we would delete the following, that is near enough to the site from which the prescription or order is transferred. That would mean that paragraph subpart 2 would read, promptly transfer the prescription to another pharmacy known to stock the legend or device to ensure the patient has timely access to the drug or device or. Okay, next, line 28, after the word patient, where there's a period, the following would be deleted. The pharmacist shall make a reasonable effort to refer the patient to a pharmacy that stocks the legend drug or device that is near enough to the referring site to ensure that the patient has timely access to the drug or device. Next, line 34, it would delete the word only. And then on line 35, at the end of that line where the word objects finishes the line, there would be a period. Line 36 would be deleted. Going on to the next page, line 1 on page 94 would be deleted through the word objection. And then there is another subpart added that reads, nothing in this section requires a pharmacy to stock any drug or device. That is the proposal.
All right, thank you, Representative Emmer. To the Emmer A28 amendment, any questions, members? Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Emmer, while I like your original bill better, and there's some things in your amendment that I do not like, I think. And you and I have talked, and I think this will get it to the conference committee, and if things don't work out in the conference committee, then there'll be nothing left of this section. So I would support this at this time.
Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Demmer, I appreciate the fact that you talked to me about this before you offered it. I guess I'd like to just ask you, what I think this does is say that that they don't have to make a reasonable effort to refer, and that's pretty much the places that you've crossed out. Is that correct? That's basically the change here?
Representative Demmer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, I did take out the reasonable effort language. That is correct. But if you go to the two preceding paragraphs, the duties still remain to provide the patient with timely access. For instance, promptly transfer the prescription to another pharmacy known to stock the legend or device is still intact. But yes, your question has to do with the reasonable referral language that has been removed.
And Mr. Chair, and Representative Emmer, can you tell me why you crossed out the word only? What does that really make a difference there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, I believe it does. I believe it expands. It doesn't restrict it to just that instance.
All right, members, any further questions? Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to Representative Goodwin's first question, I see the point you're making about provisions 1 and 2, but it's an or there. So what this provision would leave us saying is that a pharmacist could say, return the prescription and refer the patient. I don't know what refer the patient would mean in that circumstance, but more significantly, it takes away the requirement that there be timely access. So what this would leave as I'm reading it, and I understand Representative Huntley's point too, and it's kind of the speech that Representative Osmond made on the floor in the Mercury bill a couple of weeks ago, we've got to position ourselves the right way. But I just want to fully understand what's going on here. I think how this leaves the language is that there will be an option for a pharmacist to not provide a patient coming in to fill the prescription with timely access to their prescription, and I think that's a critical component of this legislation. And the other point I guess I would make is this also puts, and maybe you did that to address the second point which I'm going to raise, which it also, it puts an employing pharmacist in a very difficult position, I think, which is, and that's because you're taking out this language about, you're taking out the undue hardship language. So the owner of a pharmacy is going to be in the position of having to set up a protocol to get access to prescription, but also be forced to hire a pharmacist who won't help in that regard. And I think that is going to put the employing pharmacist in a very difficult position and kind of throw the balance of this whole legislation off kilter. So I do have those concerns. I understand your concerns about where the Senate is, but I think that this setup kind of throws the whole deal off kilter.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Member.
I suppose we can agree to disagree, Representative, but first I would disagree with you on the timely access. I think somebody yesterday in a debate that we had said it's a matter of semantics. That might be the case here. If you look at the language that you're referring to, I think that it still contemplates timely access when you say return the prescription to the patient and refer the patient. What we have taken out is the next sentence that talks about make a reasonable effort, and you and I could probably have discussed that. What does that mean? What does make a reasonable effort mean, and how does that change refer the patient? The other issue that you raise is probably the most significant issue for this committee. And it really is the reason that we're having this discussion again, is because right now, under the current state of the law, an employer is not allowed to ask questions about someone's religious beliefs in making a decision to hire. This issue has come up, even though we provide doctors and nurses with the right to exercise whatever conscience they have. We don't allow pharmacists to do the same thing. So this has come to the legislature because there is this gray area in terms of the employment issue. And the undue hardship language, as we've discussed outside of the hearing, I have with other folks, I'm sure you have, is the concern is that that's going to somehow change the law so that now pharmacists can start to let individual employees go in certain circumstances. That wasn't the intent of the law. And my understanding is that the parties would like to see if they can come up with a reasonable solution that everybody agrees on, which is the reason that I brought this amendment today in an effort, as Representative Huntley pointed out, to allow it to go forward and let them to talk and see if there's something we can do this year. If there's not, then the law will just remain as it is.
Thank you. And I understand that, and I understand that piece of it, and so I'm not objecting to that part of it. Two points, I guess, and then I can let it go. But just saying refer to the patient does take any reference to timely access out of the bill. And I mean, you kind of have to concede that point. And so I do think that it takes that piece out of it. But on the issue of the religious objection, I think under federal law, that's Title VII law, the employer, in fact, does have the right to, if it interferes with their business and creates an undue hardship on their business, you don't have to accommodate that religious belief. I believe that's the state of federal law. So I'm not sure, you know, we can have this discussion going forward, but...
But Mr. Chairman, very quickly, that was the statement that was made, I understand, in a Senate hearing on this bill. And what everybody needs to understand is the federal law doesn't create any right for you or I to run a pharmacy and ask Representative Thiessen, what's your religious belief when it comes to dispensing these drugs? You can't ask that when you hire somebody.
Mr. Chair, but if the person refuses to dispense the drug, you can certainly ask why you're doing it, and if it is an undue hardship because of religious belief, that person doesn't have a right to that job as well.
And just so everybody on the committee understands, that's what the Senate brought into play, despite an understanding that we had ahead of time. They changed the language to bring Title VII into this bill, which was not in this House version at all. Now, again, I may not agree with that. You and I might have different opinions, but that's what they would like to talk about going forward and see if they can come up with an agreement.
Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Thiessen, you said that this took timely access right out of the bill, and I'll just refer you to page 94, first sentence. Read from there. The pharmacist employer shall establish protocols that ensure that the patient has timely access.
But that's deleted, isn't it?
And, Mr. Chair, I see that that's in there, but now we're taking out language that would allow the employer to, that's kind of exactly the point that I was trying to make about taking the language about the employer and undue hardship out, because now that employer is going to be in a position of having to have this protocol to ensure timely access, but having their physician not willing to fill the prescription, and they get into a difficult spot. And I also think that it raises ambiguity if you look at what was changed in Subdivision 2 now, because it says you can return the prescription to the patient and refer the patient, and I don't know why we would take that language out. But I understand. I you make a good point.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
All right, members, any further questions to the 828 amendment? See no further questions or discussion, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of the 828 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay?
No.
The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I would suggest that we jump to the 834 amendment. I believe it's Representative Thiessen's amendment.
That's a great suggestion, Representative Bradley. Representative Thiessen's all warmed up.
Everybody says it's mine, but it's not.
Oh.
So.
Okay.
I don't have any today. How do you like that?
All right. We have a taker. Representative Towell.
Representative Holly's amendment. Essentially, what it will do is...
Are you offering an amendment, Representative?
I am going to offer the
amendment. All right. Representative Towell will move to A34 amendment. Representative Towell.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members... this will appropriate $2.3 million to purchase a limited stockpile of the antiviral Tamiflu. This is funded by, we're going to redirect the $1 million from the pandemic planning currently in the bill, and by delaying 6.1% of fiscal year 2007 public health grants until 2008. This would not... represent a cut for the counties, rather would simply delay a small portion of the payments. This appropriation will generate a 25% federal match to help cover the cost of the antiviral drugs. Essentially, there was a letter from the feds that all states are basically going to be on their own. And it's estimated that 1.5 million will be sick in Minnesota, 172,000 will be hospitalized, there will be 30,000 deaths, and we are only left, we'll have 16,000 deaths. So it's pretty essential that we take a look at this amendment.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Bradley, do you have a comment
on the amendment? I'm called about voting, but maybe we'll see whether we can dispense with this. It is, in fact, a reduction. If you look at what the response to emergencies are, a great share of it is local, and this would not be the time that we'd want to impair in any kind of way our local public health.
Right. Members, any...
Mr. Chair, and just to be clear, I think what we're doing is we're moving those dollars out 1 year. So we're not necessarily taking the dollars away from the locals. It just moves it to the next biennium, just so we're all clear in what we're doing.
Mr. Chair, I don't know what you tell the public health nurses. Do you just kind of go in limbo for a year? That's not very practical, so I'll just go with the post amendment.
All right, members, any further questions or discussion on the TAO 834 amendment? See no further questions or discussion, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of the 834 amendment, signify by...
Mr. Chair, I see a hand. I don't know if it's...
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative
Petra. Mr. Chair, I just wanted a little bit more time to look at this. I'm having a hard time understanding, so this will move out. Looking at the... You're talking about the governor's proposal, because in the House proposal we have, is that 1 million? So just if you could explain how that would do to, I'm not understanding how it's, if it's 2.3 here and 1 million here, how that moves anything out.
Mr. Representative, I understand that, first of all, President Tower takes that 1 million that we granted, to the Health Department for, as they see fit, on avian flu preparedness. So he takes that, plus he adds another 1.3 by delaying funding to the public health for 1 year, 2007. That's where the additional 1.3 comes from. That's how he gets to 2.3. And that's only for the year 2007.
Okay. Thank you.
Anybody else? Representative Goodwin.
I guess my question to this would be, how much are we funding the governor's proposal for the... avian flu issue?
Representative Bradley?
Mr. Chair, we, as I just indicated a moment ago, we are funding $1 million.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley, what did the governor recommend?
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, the governor recommended $10.5 million from the Health Care Access Fund, and then $21 million in the next biennium from the Health Care Access Fund.
So, Mr. Chair, and Representative Bradley, what can we get for $1 million?
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, I felt it was a way to keep the issue alive. None of us can predict what happens in conference committee, but at least we'll go in, have at least a marker.
Members, any further questions? Representative Pepin, you're right.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley, I just feel very strongly on the pandemic fund, and I'm very disappointed overall in the bill that we're only putting a small amount in, and so I'm not sure how I want to vote on this. I'm not sure that it makes a difference. I don't think that the money should go to stockpile Tamiflu, because it's my understanding that the different viruses could change the need and can change the formula. But just overall, I'm disappointed that we're putting such a small amount into the flu preparedness.
All right. Representative Bradley.
I'm sure just briefly to that. I know we have more needs, but the checkbook is empty. It's as simple as that.
All right, members. Representative Goodwin.
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe to address that, I'd like to know, there's about $18 million we're taking out of the Healthcare Access Fund for the Mayo Clinic, a private entity. And that money, I think, would be better spent on our immediate needs at this time. And I also want to say that, you know, not that I disagree with the Mayo Clinic doing research, certainly not, and the good job they do, but But if they can't get federal grants for that money, then there's something wrong with the research plan, because I'm sure they are eligible and I'm sure they should get it. And I have a great question about whether or not the state should start getting into the business of funding private research, or public-private partnership research, is even with a limited amount, as you said yourself, Representative Bradley, a limited amount of money this committee ever gets out of the prioritizations that go on in the leadership of the House. So I guess I would say we'd be better off putting some of that money, and I know that's your area and you want to fund the Mayo, but I think we'd be better off at least putting some of that money into some other areas in the bill.
Absolutely.
Well, Mr. Chair, Goodman, you might want to do a little research. The University of Minnesota is a prime partner in that, so it is not just the Mayo. This is statewide, and you will also find that that's leverage money, the intention of getting NIH money, and there's been very strong bipartisan support for that proposal.
All right, members. Seeing no further discussion or questions, we'll proceed to vote on the A34 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
No. The amendment is not adopted.
Mr. Chair, I do need to go up and see. What you might try is, I think Representative Ember was intending to offer the A36 amendment, and I will run and come back as quick as I can, and maybe the committee can discuss that in the meantime.
Representative Emmer, the A36 amendment.
I'd move the A36 amendment.
Representative Emmer moves the A36 amendment. Representative Emmer to that amendment.
Members, this is an amendment that follows the hearing that we had last week on a bill that had to do with special transportation services, when we were talking about giving a mileage increase to the folks in this business, and pushing the broker off for a year and some other things. And I think those of you that were here will recall the questions I had for the program administrator. I did not believe those questions were answered adequately. In fact, I would suggest those questions weren't answered at all. I believe what the numbers that the department has published on special transportation shows that while we are, as a state, basically paying the same amount, and our rides really haven't changed dramatically, the rides that we've offered, in fact, the big shift comes from special transportation services, which is supposedly the more expensive ride. Riders accessing it are being turned to ATS, or access transportation services, which are supposed to be lesser rides. But you'll recall the questions I had for the program administrator had to do with why they don't publish as part of the overall picture the ATS, the real cost of the ATS ride. They've got about $25-$26 for the ride on the STS. They've got $16 or $17 for the ride on ATS. In fact, if you figure in administrative costs, they're roughly the same, or they're close anyway. And what I've done with this amendment, I've got a series of others. What I've done with this amendment is I'm asking us to put in the bill, since the proposal is not part of the omnibus bill. I want to keep a foothold so that I can further investigate numbers. I will publicly complain about the fact that we had this hearing more than a week ago, and apparently the department decided to produce new numbers on Friday afternoon, which I got yesterday, with the idea that I would somehow get through those and figure out what's going to happen today. I will also tell all of you that the constituent that I have, that I've been working for, who's in the special transportation business, right after the hearing that we had, has been hit with an audit, which shall pass with flying colors. But whether it's coincidence or not, I would like an opportunity to put this budget-neutral amendment in the bill so that I can actually look at the numbers that the department has presented and find out what's real. That's the pitch.
Thank you, Representative Emmer. Any questions to the amendment? Representative Dean.
I was just wondering, Mr. Chair, if there's anyone from the department who's here today who might be able to address this or answer some of Representative Emmer's questions.
Yes, we see a taker here. If you could come down, please. Representative Dean, do you have a specific question, or do you just want the overall thoughts of the amendment from the department?
Mr. Chair, I think from Representative Emmer's presentation, probably just start off with a general response to Representative Emmer's amendment and question, and also the context of the data that was provided and the time frame in which it was provided to Representative Emmer.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Kathleen Cota, and I'm from the Department of Human Services. I do have some numbers for you here. I think that the best way to look at this issue is to look at numbers which include a three-year span, which include pre- and post-broker costs, which include all transportation costs, both administrative and direct service, and which include both ATS and STS. Unfortunately, the numbers that were supplied to Representative Emmer at the last hearing, I believe from some of the providers, were taken from the RFP and were not complete. They didn't include, for example, any of the PMAP costs for managed care, and they didn't address the administrative costs, both pre- and post-broker. What I tried to do in these numbers is take them directly from our claims processing system and include all of the things I just said to you so that they're absolutely complete. I'd like to give you a graph, and I'd like to give you the absolutely precise source of those numbers so that it's clear. I hope that they are presented with integrity in a straightforward manner.
And Mr. Chairman? I believe the handout that Ms. Cota is now passing out is, I believe, what I just handed out.
Right.
Same sheet.
Members, do we have?
I don't have it yet.
Mr. Chairman.
Found it. All right. Representative Powell.
I'm looking at this sheet here, spreadsheet, and I will tell you what jumps out at me here on this spreadsheet. If you go to the total trips on the, you have trips on the first section, you go to total trips, and if you move to the first quarter of fiscal year 05, and this is the first fiscal year, I believe, that the first quarter where actually the broker had taken over, the number of trips has gone from 171,000 about 172,000 to 199,000. So the number of trips have increased during the time we've gone through the broker. If you look at the program costs, if you go down near the bottom where it says direct, total direct service and administrative costs, if you look at the fourth quarter of fiscal year 03, this is where we were back at the time when we were looking at a $4.5 billion deficit. And we were looking all over the place trying to find ways to do things more efficiently at less cost and still provide the service. And as you can see, that number is $5.2 million in a quarter for this particular service we provide those that are on our medical assistance program. I worked very hard on this with Ms. Cota and with the providers. It was a very trying time for all of us. But I think if you look at what our goal was, you can find out what's happened. If you go across the page and look what happened in the final, the last 3 months of 05, which is the second quarter of 06, it's $3.8 million. So we have decreased the cost of this program to the state of Minnesota. We're still providing the services. And you can see between, if you go back up to the number of rides, we are increasing access, the number of rides, and overall, we've done it at a reduced cost. And one more point, Mr. Chairman, if I may. You look at the cost per trip, which is the last line on the page. We initially were, and this includes administrative costs, we were at $24.58 per trip. That's STS and ATS. That includes everything. We're now down to $19.30. So I believe that we've done what we set out to do. Are the providers unhappy? Yes, they are. Do they have good points that they're making? At times, yes, they do. However, saying that this has generally been a successful program, given these numbers, and I believe it does need to be fine-tuned, and I think they've done that in the RFP that has gone out just this last couple months, and they're going to fine-tune it some more. But we're learning how to do this. We've never done this before. So I think what we've done overall is we've gone for a program that really had very little oversight and was out of control, and we're beginning to bring it back under control, and we're doing it in a way that saves us money and preserves and, in fact, increases access. So that would be my point on this particular amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Carter, does the department publish these financial data figures on the department's website?
Ms. Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean and committee, do you mean this particular chart?
The costs of these two programs. Are these posted on the department?
Ms. Carter.
Representative Dean and committee, we do publish a summary data that has both the forecast and past expenses. This is all public information, though, and it's certainly available. But what comes off the MMIS warehouse is so gargantuan that, no, the whole warehouse is not published on the website.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Dean. Ms. Cota, would these figures be representative of what you would see on the website, or would they conflict with what I see on this report?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, these were put together, pulled right off of the MMIS warehouse to show the trend. So I staff put these together specifically to help this issue be more clear. So no, I don't think you'd see this exact duplicate on this website.
Representative Dean?
Thanks.
Yep. Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple of questions for you, Ms. Cota, because I didn't realize we were going to go back through all the graphs that we created last week, because you know I went through all the numbers, and to suggest that I got them just from the providers, I think, is somewhat misleading, Anne, because, in fact, the numbers that I used at the hearing we had a couple of weeks ago were taken directly from the RFP that was created by your department, and I see you nodding, so you understand that. Do I understand correctly that since the meeting, the hearing that we had on Representative Powell's proposal for special transportation, you went back and put this spreadsheet together? Is that correct? Ms. Cota.
Representative Emmer, actually, no. John Kowalsik had that spreadsheet put together already, and we didn't have it. I didn't have it with me, but I could have. This is not new numbers. We needed to do this in order to put the RFP together. But the difficulty with the RFP numbers is that they weren't complete.
Mr. Chairman,
they were put together for different purposes.
Representative Emmer.
We'll get to the RFP in a second. I understand that your position is it's not complete, and that's another issue. So today I understand for the first time that this spreadsheet that is in front of me was in fact available at the time of the hearing that was held on Representative Powell's bill. Is that a correct understanding?
Representative Emmer, yes, we did have a slightly sloppier version of this back at the shop that we were working off of, because we needed to understand this, of course, in order to make some of the decisions we've made.
Mr. Chairman, and you know, this just opens up all kinds of questions, and I don't know how much time we want to take today, because you say we were working off a somewhat sloppy version because we had to understand what we're doing. My understanding is you're the program administrator for this project, isn't that correct? Ms. Cora.
That's right, Representative Emmer. And when I say sloppy, I mean, for instance, the title wasn't as descriptive as this title. It wasn't put together in a way that you could present. It was one of many sheets of numbers that we work with.
Mr. Chairman?
And yes, I am the administrator.
Representative Emmer.
Ms. Cota, you put together the RFP when?
The RFP was authored, put together within the last 2 to 3 months.
Mr. Chairman? Now, prior to the hearing, that was held in front of this committee on Representative Powell's bill. My understanding is that you're aware that I sat down with Chairman Bradley and Representative Powell and went over them in detail the concerns that I had. That it's, I was told that you had been notified of that prior to the hearing and that you were also notified, be prepared to answer Representative Emmer's questions. Isn't that correct?
That's correct, Representative Emmer.
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Emmer.
Ms. Cota, so when you came to the hearing, and I had the specific concerns that I asked you. You remember the first question I asked was that you had come up with a cost of pushing the broker off from a year ago, that it was going to be somewhere around $500,000 or more, and I asked what had happened to those savings. You remember that was the first question that I asked that night?
I believe so.
Representative.
And all of this was available to share with us at that point, right?
Representative Emmer, that's correct.
Now, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Cota, after that hearing, we won't get into what I understand apparently happened after the meeting, but you never came back to see me. In fact, this spreadsheet was apparently made available late Friday. Is that right?
Representative Emmer, we did, I believe I forwarded this to Representative Powell on Friday. That's correct.
Representative Emmer.
All right. We need to talk, Mr. Chairman, briefly about the RFP, because I think this is exactly why my amendment is necessary, and with all due respect to Representative Powell, there are some even bigger problems that I didn't realize, and I asked the committee to consider this. Ms. Cota, you say that the RFP is incomplete. Have you explained that to folks that are actually involved in the bidding process?
Representative Emmer, when I say that the RFP is incomplete, I mean that it was incomplete for purposes of this committee looking at figures. And here's why. For example, we are not including the PMAP trips in the formula that we are asking the bidders to use when they bid on the average cost of a trip. So for us to have included the PMAP trips in the historical data would have given them a false picture. They need to make a business decision about by looking at the past and then coming up with a bid for the future. If PMAP trips are not going to be part of what they're bidding on in the future in that particular pricing mechanism, then you don't want to put it in the history because it would paint a false picture. So when I say they were incomplete, I mean only for the purposes of the discussion that we had last week. They absolutely are complete for the purposes of the RFP.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Emmer.
Well, that's great then, because what is in those numbers, and we went over it last week, is in roughly the 11 months before the RFP was issued, which you're asking people to make business decisions on, the rides really didn't change. There's a difference in ridership of about 2,000 plus at the end of that 11-month period, and just 2 months earlier there was a negative 7,000. Isn't that right?
Representative, I don't recall that detail.
All right.
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, what is important to folks that are bidding this business during that 11-month period is that the total number of dollars spent on special transportation needs in the state of Minnesota remained roughly the same. Isn't that correct?
Ms. Cota.
Representative Emmer, the RFP, they're not bidding on any STS trips. They're bidding on ATS trips.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that answered my question. The numbers that I gave you, and I've got the graphs up in my office that I did myself off the numbers you've got in the RFP, indicate that the total number of dollars you're representing in your RFP to people bidding on it, total number of dollars has not changed dramatically, if at all, in the last 10, 11 months prior to the RFP.
Representative Emmer, I'm not trying to be evasive, but without having that document in front of me, it's hard for me to be responsive to that question. I don't know which line you're talking about.
All right. Well, I have others on the list, Representative Emmer, so if you want to take a break here, Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just actually reading these numbers. I think you can do whatever you want with these numbers, but if you just look at Representative Powell's interpretation, if the fourth quarter of 2003 is the baseline year, and then we've achieved some success in quarter two fiscal year 2006. To me, like, there's actually less trips being spent. There's 211,000 or 212,000 in the baseline year, and then 199,000 in this chunk here. And I noticed the significance is that the biggest savings has come from a shift from STS to ATS, which is the specialized transportation, which is more expensive than the ATS, which is the bus and taxis and whatever. And notice the administrative costs have gone from 13% in the baseline year to 17% in the current year, which I'm not sure if that's our goal, is to put more money into admin or to try to push the money down. And it seems to me, I remember this discussion, I've watched Epson and Powell take it on, I thought, in an admirable way, and picked up again in the third or fourth round here with another interested member. But it seems to me that the savings that's come on the price per trip is simply in the shift from STS to ATS in a proper way. And I think that the group that was here a couple of years ago now was willing to do the very same thing on their own. And I'm not convinced, at least in these numbers, and talking to these folks over a period of these years, that this couldn't have been achieved without a broker. And I think that these people, and what, as a person who writes notes for people to get rides, I suggested early on that there would be a statement of ability written by the physician, not a statement of need. But I would say they could walk 200 feet, that they need assistance at the 200-foot mark, and so on. Then somebody would decide what that could be. The department, we thought, at that point, could create a list of criteria that the providers had to abide by. And I guess I'm concerned that I see an increasing nick by the whoever the broker is. I don't know who it is, but at a larger share of this money going out. And I do have one question just from this quota. Do you know how many of these providers have gone out of business since this was instituted in the beginning? Do you know all that offhand?
This quota.
Representative Abler and committee, I don't know offhand.
To that point, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Powell, to that point?
To a couple points. Yes, there have been providers go out of business because of our switch from STS to ATS. That was known up front. That was always known up front. Number two, as to the number of rides, I think you should, the better comparison would look from the first quarter of 05, which was 172, out to the second quarter of 06, which is 199. That's the that's when the period that we've had the broker. So the access has gone up during that time. And as for the point whether or not the providers would have done this on their own, they had done a lot on their own to bring costs down prior to the legislation in 03. But the history of this business is that we were in a position where there was no oversight. Physicians, for instance, don't care how people get to their clinic for their appointment. They just want to see them there. So they'll sign anything. They will sign anything. And what we were out of, it was out of control. We were taking people in inappropriate ways to their medical appointments. The whole point of this was if they could go by bus, we send them by bus. If they can go by volunteer driver, they go by volunteer driver. That's what this was about. And yes, it took a lot of business away from the STS providers, but it did so in an appropriate way. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Abler?
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Cota, when you were here a couple weeks ago, you testified to the fact that your department had expanded the brokering to an additional four counties recently. Is that right?
Representative, that's correct.
And I believe the exact words you used were, after we made that expansion and the providers started to lose critical mass, we pulled back. You remember that testimony?
I do, Representative Ember, and the providers that we were concerned about were all of the voluntary organizations that were operating in the second and third tier suburbs with the counties. And some of those organizations started to lose critical mass, and that was of great concern to us because we don't want to lose the least expensive provider. And that was one of the primary reasons why, partly at the advice of the counties, that we determined that the program works best in the seven county metro area.
Representative Emmer.
Well, that's, Mr. Chairman, that raises two questions. One has to do with I need confirmation from Ms. Cota that then those were the folks that we expect, whether they're volunteer or for profit, those were the folks that we expected would go out of business, and that was known up front. I need confirmation about that first. And then second, you need to maintain the folks that are providing the service. My understanding is that we either just got notice of losing or we're in the process of getting notice of losing someone. Your biggest provider of, is it Access Transportation Services?
Representative Emmer, in relationship to your first question, no, we did not expect those volunteer organizations to start to lose capacity. We never expected that. We would never have wanted that to happen, and that's why as soon as it did start to happen, we pulled back. We did expect that we would lose some of the smaller, more expensive STS providers, and that did happen, and that was okay. In response to your second question, I was told yesterday that there was one metro taxi company that was going to pull back as a subcontractor with the broker. And at this point, our contractor felt that they would be able to manage coverage of the rides without that subcontractor.
Mr. Chairman.
Two things. So, Ms. Cota, first, you did expect to put some STS providers out of business by expanding into the 11 county metro?
Representative Emmer and committee, we had well over 100 STS providers in the metro area. Some of them were one person who was taking one or two PCA clients. We had some very unusual smaller companies that were only taking ambulatory people, et cetera. And yes, we did have people that were providing STS services that weren't critical, and we did feel they probably would fall off, and they did, and it wasn't an impact on the clients.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Emmer.
Ms. Cota, have you, as the director of the program, learned anything in respect to how your hope to expand this brokering to a statewide basis, based on your experience in these four counties where it actually hurt your ability to provide special transportation services? Have you derived any understanding of how that may hurt the ability to administer this statewide?
Representative Emmer and committee, we've learned a number of things in the first 2 years of the broker experience. The first is a very important lesson that in the rural areas, transportation systems are very fragile, particularly the less expensive volunteer ones, as well as the STS ones, and are not nearly as amenable to a broker approach as is the metro core area. So yes, we're much more reticent about a statewide broker. We've also learned that, by and large, people in nursing homes do qualify for STS and don't need to be reviewed. We've learned that there's a big difference between the 11 county and the 7 county area. And we've tried to put those lessons into our forward RFP.
Mr. Chairman,
November.
Well, then, to wrap it up for the committee, I take it based on that answer that supports the amendment that I'm coming forward with, which is asking to push this statewide brokering back another year. If our recent experience has shown that this is actually going to hurt access, I think it's worth not only would I like an opportunity, and Ms. Cota, I'd ask for the opportunity to actually have some time to work with you to go through these numbers rather than have them dropped on me the day before. But also, it appears that if we can possibly push it back a year to study this a little bit closer before we start putting other folks out of business and further restricting access, I think it would be wise.
Representative Abler.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'm enjoying the math of this whole chart. It's the whole chart of numbers. Anyway, it's been a while. But I just have some more questions, and I'm really glad that there's a few of our members working on this. I hope they can come to an agreement, and I think the process would be better for it if there's a way to decide that part. But I have a couple of questions. One, looking at the 05 quarter one as the baseline, at the advice reps and Paul, I was looking at the noticing that the DHS admin has gone to almost nothing here. I do notice that the administrative costs have grown, are increasing relatively steadily I didn't add up 05 first quarter, but it goes from 400,000 to 592,604,636. And that the overall cost is about flat. It's about $3.9 million average in 05 and about the same number in 06. So it's a relatively flat cost, but that would still consume that we're putting a greater percentage to administration. Ms. Cota, can you tell me where you expect that to top out at? Like if in 06 quarter 2 at 636, this 411 in 05 quarter 2, what do you think that the next year will hold? Is this going to be a greater percentage? Is it just going to suddenly get level at that point, or is it going to continue to increase in actual dollars?
Representative Cota. Representative Abler and committee, I think the fair way to look at administrative costs is to look at the total administrative costs line that is at the bottom of that section of numbers. And if you'll notice in 03, our administrative costs were 662, and in 06, our administrative costs are 636. So my first point would be that they've gone down, not up. And my second, my direct answer to your question is, I believe that the administrative costs should be leveling now because the ridership is starting to level.
Ms. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Ms. Cody, you had me there until you talked about comparing it to the old way. I'm trying to go with the broker system, not with the old.
Representative Abler, the reason why the numbers continue to go up is because they reflect an increase in ridership. In the beginning, they had fewer rides, so they had lower total admin costs, and in the end, they had more rides, so they had more admin. So the increase of the broker's admin costs is a function of the increase in trips as they built their clientele. As the providers who were not using the service found the service, called the number, you know, scheduled the trips.
Well, I guess I'll... math was one of my things I really liked when I was in the college and high school world and all, and I appreciate numbers. You can generally want numbers, but if you would plot the lines from fiscal year 05, quarter 1, quarter 2, you see a straight line almost going up, and it's going to surpass the old baseline if the slope that would continue. And so I'll only offer it as a concern, and next year we come back, we'll talk about the same matter, we'll see if we're right. I'm concerned, as a person who lives in a world of administrative costs, not your department of DHS, but other different department has me send in forms, and a greater and greater part of my business goes to overhead. The more it goes to overhead, it doesn't go to serve my patients, to pay my staff, to keep my fees low. It goes into just bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. And some of it's necessary, some of it's not, but I'm hopefully don't get to the point where the bureaucracy part of this, which could have been achieved maybe for free anyway by some things that were brought forward by these same people, is going to consume several of the businesses that we were trying to preserve. And so for no benefit to the client and no benefit to the state and harm to the individuals who have tried to serve in this area, sometimes at very narrow margins that we cause some harm. And I'll be supporting the amendment.
In response to that, we have to share your concern. We don't want admin costs to go up. So we structured the RFP for the next year very differently than the past. In the past, we paid administrative costs on a fee-for-service basis to the broker so that every time they arranged the trip, they got a payment. We've structured the administrative fees in the future and for the people who are bidding, the companies that are bidding, so that it's part of an average cost, so they're to some extent at risk for using too much administrative costs. It's the way that you build incentives so that you're sure that they have an incentive not to continue to increase their admin costs. So we directly are in response to your concern.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, is the RFP that just went out for statewide or is it for the metro area?
Ms. Cota.
Representative, it's for the 7-county metro area.
Is this, Mr. Chair, is this language going to make any difference, practically speaking to you? Are you going to expand statewide before July 1st, 2007?
Ms.
Cota. Representative and committee, I think the honest answer to that is probably not. The only way in which we would look at non-metro expansion would be to try to work with providers in areas where there were high population concentrations, and there's only two or three of those in the non-metro area.
Okay, thank you.
President Powell.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. And then we're going to vote on this.
Very good. To add what Ms. Cota said in response to Representative Abler's concern about increasing administrative costs, now, as the point has been made, we are learning as we go on. And one suggestion I had made in 2003, if you are an independent
position where you are living in a nursing home or ICFMR or something like that, then you should automatically have a level of need of SES. Well, the department at the time did not want to go along with that. They have now found that, in that case, I was correct, and that we're going to save quite a bit of money by just automatically designating those people as being SES. So we are learning as we go on. Now, as to the amendment itself, if this committee wants to micromanage the Department of Human Services on how they run their program, or this or any other program, go ahead and vote for the amendment. But I think that given the situation we are in, we are measurably better off, and that we should allow the department to continue on in the way they see fit with oversight from us. But I would ask that we not vote for this amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you. Members, we need to vote on this, so see no further questions. All those in favor of the EMR A36 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay.
No.
The amendment is adopted. All right, members, if you could save all the info that we have left in your packet, we will be going into recess shortly here, and we'll come back at 4 p.m. in room 5. Representative Powell moves the April 10th, 2006 minutes. Any discussion on that? See no discussion. All those in favor of the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
As opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted. Members, we will be in recess till 4 p.m. We'll call this meeting back to order. All right, members, we are back to the amendments, and we will start off with the A08 amendment. A08 amendment. Representative Abler.
Thanks. I'm just looking for the department. I hope they're here. Oh, there they are. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A8 amendment, and the department can come down and clarify. The issue that I believe this addresses is there's a series of ongoing questions about the whole long-term care partnership. We discussed this at some length in the committee, so I won't bother with any more details about that. But, why don't you come to the table? And the part of this has to do with Justin Westrum's concerns from civil law about what happens if the assets you've delegated or designated at the time of eligibility actually go down in value. If they go up in value, you can't exceed the protection that you have in the policy. But if you go down in value, then there's some other questions about that. Maybe the department can comment about what this amendment does and what they will do in the interim time, Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler moves the A8 amendment. Ms. Carlin, welcome back to the committee. You can proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, this amendment is drafted to require the department to look at a plan and draft legislation that would allow individuals to disregard an additional amount of assets to those that are protected under the long-term care partnership for the purposes of, if you will, a kind of a secondary protection against depreciation in the value of those protected assets. There's many things to consider in this plan, and so we would come back to the legislature next year and outline for you how this might work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
And just to clarify, this is not my work. It's Representative Westrum's work, so I'm just carrying it on his behalf since he doesn't serve here. I understand the part on lines 116 or 115 thereafter talks about if they go down. What is the contingent part? Do you actually carve out more value than you have just in case it goes down, or how would that? And it probably is. It's going. You're looking into it, so we're not binding ourselves to do it. You're bringing a plan forward, but how does that work, and what would it mean maybe if you did it?
Ms. Collins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, under the long-term care partnership, a person can disregard for purposes of eligibility an amount of assets equal to the amount of benefits that they have exhausted under a long-term care insurance policy. Representative Westrum wanted us to look at a way to protect against any depreciation in the value of those assets that are disregarded, so that when we get to the estate recovery and they could realize the full protection to the extent that they have them. Maybe I should give a little more explanation. When someone applies for medical assistance under the long-term care partnership, they have to have the regular asset limit of $3,000. In addition, then they can disregard this amount of assets equal to the amount of benefits utilized or exhausted under a long-term care insurance policy. So, for example, if they had $100,000 of benefits utilized, at the time they apply for medical assistance, they can disregard $100,000 plus the $3,000 asset limit, in addition to any excluded assets. Once we get to estate recovery, that $100,000 that they protected under the partnership at the time they applied for medical assistance for long-term care, that amount is protected from estate recovery. So the $100,000 they disregarded up front cannot be recovered under estate recovery. I believe Representative Westrom's concern was that if they designated $100,000 at the time of eligibility and the value of those assets depreciated, then they wouldn't have that protection of estate recovery. First, the only way that you would be able to utilize this is if you had excluded assets that weren't counted at the time, or you accumulated additional assets during your lifetime, perhaps from an inheritance, maybe if your spouse predeceased you, that type of thing.
Mr.
Representative,
I understand the recovery part. How would this work? I mean, this is what you're asking to look into, I know, but how does it work on the eligibility part? So you would actually set aside $25,000 more in assets and disregard those for eligibility? Is that what he's asking us to do? Or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, yes, my understanding is that Representative Westrom would like the department to recommend a certain percentage, perhaps on based on a type of asset, a straight amount. This is what I believe we're supposed to come back with in the plan. So, for example, if we determined that, and this is totally example purpose, let's say we said 20%, and $100,000 had been protected at the time under the partnership. If we had contingent assets of 20%, that would be an additional $20,000 that someone could set aside to be disregarded for purposes of eligibility. At the time of estate recovery, only $100,000 is protected from recovery. So to the extent that the value of those assets had depreciated, then you could take an amount of these contingent assets and designate them for protection. If they still had the original $100,000, then the amount that had been set aside and named as the contingent exempt assets would be available for recovery. So in no case would you ever be able to protect more than the amount of benefits you had utilized under the long-term care insurance policy.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm learning more than I wanted this time of the afternoon. but I'm okay with the amendment. I think particularly the notion that if you have an asset that's been involved here that actually depreciates, it ought to be whatever it's worth at the time that we're making our claim on it, and I think that's fair. So I support the amendment.
Representative Chamba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This maybe goes in a different direction, but a lot of times, especially with farmland, the values go up, and sometimes it's based on the percentages as far as what you can recoup, and so how does that work?
Ms. Carlin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Otremba, under the Long-Term Care Insurance Partnership, again, we just stress that the total amount that can be protected from recovery is the amount that was utilized under the partnership policy. I don't work in the estate recovery area, but my understanding is that during estate recovery, there's a process for which a person evaluates the assets they have. So the asset that was designated up front, to the extent that it doesn't exceed the amount, and again, I'll go to my example of $100,000. $100,000 of that asset would be protected from recovery, and any value above that would be subject to recovery. It kind of depends on which asset it is. If it's an asset that was counted at the time of eligibility and it's disregarded under the partnership, it's just set aside. But in addition, a person may have assets that are excluded at the time of application, and those assets are actually not counted, so would maybe still there in, at the time of recovery in addition to the original amount that was designated. Under the long-term care partnership plan, a person could designate their excluded assets for protection under recovery. And in all cases, the amount that is disregarded can't be more than the $3,000 asset limit plus the amount that's protected under the partnership. So to the extent that a person has no other excluded assets or doesn't accumulate additional assets during their lifetime, the value is pretty much set at the time of eligibility.
Representative Otremba. Well,
Mr. Chair, in the case of, let's say, farming, you might not have accumulated any more assets, but your assets may have gone up. So does that work the same as if you have accumulated more assets?
Ms. Carlin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Otremba, yes. Again, if the asset you have in the state recovery is worth $500,000 and the amount that's protected is $100,000, the $100,000 is the only amount that's protected from recovery. The additional $400,000 would be available to be recovered.
Members, any further questions on the Eighth Amendment? See no further questions. We'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of the Eighth Amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay?
No.
The amendment is adopted.
Chair, I would suggest that we do A19-1.
The A19-1 amendment. Who wants to take responsibility for that one?
I'll take responsibility, Mr. Chair.
Representative Otremba moves the A19-1 amendment. Representative Otremba, it's your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Basically, this amendment is the benefits set for adults without children above the 75% federal poverty level. This would enable adults without children to receive coverage for dental care, eyeglasses, hearing aids, home aid, medical transportation, physical and occupational therapy, and adult mental services. This amendment has a cost of around $3 million in the current biennium and would impact about 17,000 adults without children. And I would cover this under the Healthcare Access Fund and would reduce that number of dollars which go toward reducing MSHA's assessment.
Members, to the A19-1 amendment. Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, I would have to oppose the amendment. First of all, it's cutting back on an important thing we're doing, and secondly, I think that these kind of initiatives are better waiting until we have a regular funding session, so I would oppose the amendment.
Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, over the past 4 years, we've removed $580 million from the Healthcare Access Fund to fund the general fund activities. And in order to have that number up there, one of the things we did was reduce the benefits that adults without kids get. We have a surplus in the Healthcare Access Fund that currently, that Healthcare Access Fund is supposed to be dedicated to people that are eligible for Minnesota care, and this simply gets rid of the reduced benefit set and restores it back to where it was in the early 2000s. There's things in here like instead of having to go to, right now if you need an eye exam, according to the benefits that we have, you have to go see an ophthalmologist. You can't see an optometrist. Those kinds of things are just foolish. We need to use the Healthcare Access Fund for what it was intended, and this amendment helped us do that.
Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think Representative Huntley covered most of what I was going to say. I would just say that I think without covering these things for adults,
without children, we're ending up spending more in the long run, because we had testimony from the dentist yesterday that physical health problems are a result of the lack of dental care and hearing aids, home care, medical transportation. Those kinds of things should be covered for people that don't have children too, because otherwise they end up on another form of public assistance or it ends up with uncompensated care. And it seems to me a very small cost, $3 million, very small cost to cover these folks. And I know a lot of the folks that are on this are also on Social Security disability at least the first year, and they have sometimes very, very serious disabilities. And they need those services. So I would support Representative O'Trembler's amendment.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just briefly to the point about cutting back on something that's in this bill that's very important. I think the testimony yesterday that the MCHA changes here would save about $60 a year to the average employer, and this $3 million reduction would mean that $60 is reduced to $58.50 a year. And so I don't know if it's really that. Doing the things that we want to do to protect some health care for adults without children may be worth $1.50 to those employers.
Any further discussion on the A19-1 amendment? Further discussion? Seeing none, we'll proceed to vote. Okay. Roll call has been requested. Clerk will take the roll.
Bradley?
No.
Finstead?
No.
Gabler?
No.
Dean?
Nope.
Deacon? Camera? Goodwin?
Yes.
Huntley?
Yes.
Otremba?
Yes.
Steppen?
No.
Powell?
No.
Samuelson?
No.
Tao? Thiessen?
Yes.
Walker?
Yes.
Wilkin?
No.
Seeing 5 ayes and 8 nays, the amendment is not adopted.
Mr. Chair, I would suggest that we do the A22-2 amendment next.
All right, the A22-2.
That would be mine, Mr. Chair.
Representative Goodwin.
This amendment does is increase from $10,000 to $20,000 the cap on Minnesota Care inpatient hospital coverage for adults without children and parents with incomes above 175% of poverty. It costs roughly $1.1 million in 07 and roughly $3.7 to $3.8 million in the upcoming biennium. And it would be covered out of the Health Care Access Fund and would then reduce the amount of Health Care Access Fund dollars that go towards the MCHA assessments. The amendment not only would provide relief for hospitals, but would also and should also provide relief from medical assistance and other forms of public assistance that might have to be used if the hospital bill is over $10,000 and up to $20,000. I think there's, again, some of the things we've done in the past have been seriously costing our system a lot more money, whether it's the state, the federal government, or the private health carriers or private health providers. I think it's to say that to have a cap like $10,000 on hospital care is almost like having no coverage for hospital care at all. And I know the people in my district that are covered by Minnesota Care, they pay up to $350 a month in premiums for their family, if they have a family of three. And they the child would be covered, but the parents would not be covered for anything over $10,000 at the current time. That's a pretty low threshold, and I don't know how much hospital service you can get for $10,000, but I'd be betting it wouldn't be more than a couple days or so. I broke my leg in 11 places a couple years ago, and it turned out to be a cost of $150,000 for 3 days in the hospital and surgery. So I think it really is $10,000 is almost like not having it. The Health Care Access Fund was meant to cover these costs, but working people that have Minnesota Care are paying premiums. They're working people paying premiums, and they should have better coverage than what they have right now. The dollars in the, once again, just like with Representative Otremba's amendment, the dollars in the Health Care Access Fund were meant to provide health care, and we're not using them for that currently. So I would like to offer this to increase the cap on the inpatient, and I'd like to get a roll call. Thank you.
Roll call has been requested, Representative.
I've got one oral amendment to that that I forgot here. There was a mistake in line 3.2. So the amount to MCHA is only reduced by, so it's page 97, line 28, delete 87.5 million, and insert, it says 43.3, but cross that out and instead put 85,896,000. So we're only deleting it by a very small amount, but by doing that, we're only changing it by a little amount, but by doing that, we're saving on compensated care and probably a lot of costs to our other programs. So,
Representative Goodwin will incorporate that change. Members, do you have that change? I see heads nodding. Okay. Roll call has been requested. Discussion on the A22-2 amendment. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank goodness for the amendment, because that simply wouldn't have worked. We'd have been in the red in the next biennium. Notwithstanding that, I would make the same comment. I don't think that this is the time for the committee to start redesigning Minnesota Care. We've established an important objective, and I think we should say that the 10,000 limit was established because it was understood that the people using Minnesota Care were very low income, low asset working people who, if they had an occurrence, would be able to spend down, whether it's 10,000 or 20,000, that principle still exists. So I would oppose the amendment.
Discussion on the A22-2 amendment. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Bradley. True, I understand that this isn't technically our budget year, but while families are sometime in these situations, they can't wait every 2 years. There are sometimes, especially when you have an opportunity and you have a surplus in the Minnesota Care Fund, Care Access Fund, to be able to utilize a couple million dollars and to be able to utilize what it was intended for, I think it's worth doing. You know, if you end up going into the hospital with the unknown, all you know is that you lost 50 pounds, that you are, your blood count is low, you have hit being way as scary as being anemic, you find out you need a blood transfusion, and then from there, tests are occurred. And while our doctors are great, you know, they are practicing physicians, and they may not be able to know right away. Normally when you're anemic and your blood gets that low, there's usually some internal bleeding. And so what you have to do is utilize one of the expensive tests. And when that test comes back okay, they give you another expensive test. And when that test comes back okay, guess what? They give you another expensive test. And you can be in the hospital for just 4 days, 5 days, and walk away with a $35,000 bill and no means to cover that $25,000 bill. And hopefully they have found out what was wrong and they can correct it. Whether they did or not, you're still walking away and you're going to end up having one or two things happen. First thing that's going to happen is the hospital is going to send you a bill. You're not going to be able to pay it. They're going to send you a few more bills, and then they're going to send you to the collections, and the collections are going to come after you. You're still not going to be able to pay for it. And so the last thing that ends up happening, whether we like to admit it or not, it comes out in uncompensated care for our hospitals and our counties. And that is happening more often than not when you have individuals that are working hard, that are struggling to pay their everyday expenses, but then end up having an unfortunate situation and having a health care crisis and causing the rest of the health care system a crisis because they can't afford to pay for their medical bills. I support the amendment.
Assemblywoman Tremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think we can wait till next year. The money from the Health Care Access Fund will be gone, and I think this is the time to do it.
Representative Goodwin.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley, I appreciate your comments. I only have to say that your arguments are, in my opinion, very weak, because even though this isn't a budget year, we've got all kinds of budget items going on in this bill, huge policy changes like the Minnesota Care Fund going for MCHA and, $18 million to the Mayo Clinic. And we've got lots and lots of budget issues, major decisions that we have either had very little discussion on or not a lot at any rate. So this is one where we can improve the integrity of what we've been telling people we're collecting money for by using it for the services. And it's such a small amount. Had I known it was only $1.1 million, I would have said, let's go five times that and spend $5 million and then get some real coverage for these folks on in hospital costs. Because this is a pittance. $1.1 million is a pittance, and I really think it's well worth the money, and I really have trouble with the funds going to MCHA anyway, but outside of that, if it does, it reduces it just a little bit. So I would ask for your support, and again, ask for a roll call vote.
We still have the roll call vote. Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just point out that, again, what Representative Bradley said, that this isn't a budget year, that before the highest that the inpatient limit has been $10,000. You're asking now to double that at a time when this is not the time to do it. We made the decisions last year of what the limits were going to be. We increased the outpatient limit to unlimited last year. Outpatient on Minnesota Care, and we went from 5,000 to 10,000. Before 2003, it was 10,000 for inpatient care, and so I think this is doubling that. We've never been this high before on this particular program, and to do it in a non-budget year at the last committee hearing of the year seems to be, this would probably have been better off presented to us at the beginning of session.
Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Paul, if this is not a finance year, then why are we taking $120 million out of the Health Care Access Fund to spend on things that aren't supposed to be, the Health Care Access Fund is not supposed to be used for? Seems to me this is a finance year.
All right, members, any further discussion? See no further discussion. The clerk will take the roll.
Bradley.
No.
Hempstead.
No.
Abler.
No.
Dean.
Nope.
Eakin. Remember. Goodwin.
Yes.
Huntley.
Yes.
Wotremba.
Yes.
Pepin.
No.
Powell.
No.
Samuelson.
No.
Powell. Jason.
Yes.
Walker. Wilkin.
No.
There being five yes and eight no's, the amendment is not adopted.
Mr. Chair, I would suggest, I believe it would be A23 as the next amendment to be offered.
Mr. Chairman?
Sam Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, let's see. Let's try. Hopefully we can get some bipartisan support on this. I'm really excited about the opportunity to have this amendment. Head hurts, but it's I'm feeling really good about the possibility. And it actually goes to the brief statement that I made earlier this morning with Representative Bradley's amendment with the aging and adult services, and what the intent of Minnesota Care and the Healthcare Access Fund is really supposed to be doing. And I'm not sure if members have read statute, but in statute under 295.581, you know, prohibits on non-Minnesota Care transfers from funds. You know, it gets into the wonderful wording, notwithstanding any law to the contrary, and notwithstanding section, and we can go on and on. Money in the Healthcare Access Fund shall be appropriated only for purposes that are consistent with past and current Minnesota Care appropriations. I think we're this precedent that we've been doing the last few years and stealing money, and I say stealing money from the Healthcare Access Fund because I believe the intent was to expand the opportunity for working adults to be able to be covered. And the last couple years, there has been a minimum that we are being able to document through the department of almost 100 more thousand individuals that are uninsured that are working. I think in the times that we're in, and although there are tough decisions to be made, we have tons of things that we would like to fund. It's not a budget year. We should be, you know, growing the Healthcare Access Fund to really be able to go back to where we were in 03 and 05 and reinstating the eligibility cuts that we have been putting out in the out of this committee in the last few years, out of this body in the last few years. The amount of money that we've spent in just eligibility is almost $350 million in cuts. Now, one could say, well, the individuals still have coverage, but these are still individuals that are working poor individuals for the most part that have put money elsewhere in the system. That, again, like I said before, we pay no matter what. We pay either up front and making sure individuals are covered, and then having the opportunity for the department to set up deals with the hospitals and other providers, or we pay after the fact when these individuals end up in uncompensated care in situations. What my amendment does is basically is very clear. It's saying that the true purpose of the Healthcare Access Fund will be to serve low-income Minnesotans and Minnesotan families. That would be solely it. The other part of it is making sure that we're not taking the money for other programs that we would love to fund. This morning, having to leave and come to Ways and Means, and listening to the debate, and then last night also on the constitutional amendments and how we should be funding things, and we realize that we don't have a lot of money, and there's a lot of things that we would like to do. There's a lot of things that we're supposed to do. There's a lot of things that we need to do. And a lot of debate around where the money is coming from. And it's very interesting to me. We might not have money for arts. We might not have money for clean water. We might not have money for a lot of different things. But guess what? Technically, we do have money to do some things around health care. But instead of doing things around health care, instead of expanding coverage for individuals that are working and having the opportunity to get good, adequate health care for their families and making sure it's not coming down on the system, we are actually limiting that opportunity and taking the Healthcare Access Fund money and applying it to other things, including things that aren't even in this committee. I think that the public needs to know that the commitment that they had to Minnesota Care, their commitment the providers had, physicians and others had to Minnesota Care, and making sure that this tax was going to a fund to expand health care, that we're really serious about doing that, and I'd like to keep the money where it's at and be able to come back in 2007 and really look at the eligibility standards and get back to what Minnesota Care is set out to be.
Representative Walker moves the A23 amendment. Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Walker, how would you define low income?
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Powell. I actually will look to counsel for that in what's currently in statute under the program.
Mr. Chun?
Mr. Chair, Representative Powell, the Minnesota Care Program currently covers families and children up to 275% of the federal poverty guidelines, and it covers adults without children up to 175% of the federal poverty guidelines.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, translated into English that people can understand. I get confused a lot of times with, you know, the percentage of poverty and children and how many you have in the family. But we have, if you look at the rate books for MinnesotaCare, you'll find that there are families making $60,000 and more that are on MinnesotaCare. Excuse me, it is true. I see a lot of shakings of heads, but Representative Aver handed out a few pages last year of the rate book, and that was at $60,000, correct?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Powell has the floor here.
Okay.
And I'm done. Go ahead.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Powell, the parents wouldn't qualify, just the children. And to also keep in mind, those individuals will be paying a co-payment and a premium. It's not a free ride. Just because you're making $60,000 doesn't just guarantee you without your fair share into the system.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Powell.
We've had testimony that full payment for MinnesotaCare, given, you know, really the benefit sets that are there now, inpatient, outpatient, would be anywhere from $800 to $1,100 a month. If that would be full payment, but yet the top payment per month for insurance of MinnesotaCare is somewhere around $330 to $50 a month. So the fact is that we are already providing folks that I wouldn't call poor or low income insurance under MinnesotaCare, and to say that this is reserved for low-income Minnesotans, it just isn't correct.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's interesting that we always focus on the high extreme instead of the individuals making $20,000. There are many more of those individuals that are struggling. The eligibility, we can play with that around. We look at that all the time. We don't have to look at the top tier. We can look at the bottom tier. We can go back to Representative Otremba's amendment that she had that just failed. There are individuals, or actually Representative Goodwin's amendment, that individuals that are still struggling, that are making $20,000 or $30,000, with even one child, with two children, that are not able to make it because of the amount of rent that they have to pay, or their extreme property taxes if they're homeowners, or just because one incident. It only takes, you know, I have always been thankful of some of the things, well, everything that my mother's taught me, but one of the true blessings that she's always taught me, nothing is promised to you. I walk out of here, I got good health care, I got excellent car insurance, and I'm only an accident away from poverty myself. And so these individual families, knowing that they're hardworking adults, they're not individuals that aren't working, they're working Minnesotans, that because of the way that the system is set up, and I agree with you, the fact that our system is separate and, you know, everyone in the committee knows how I feel about single payer. Everyone in the committee knows how I feel about universal health care. It's not that there's different rates. The true issue is that the system requires uninsured individuals to pay more. And we have more uninsured individuals, and if we have an opportunity to insure more individuals, that's what we should be using the Health Care Access Fund for.
Absolutely.
Let's get the realistic here. If you're single adult without kids, and you make $8.26 an hour, you make too much money to be on MinnesotaCare, even though your income is about $17,150. If you were to go out in the market and buy health insurance for yourself, it's going to be, assuming you were healthy, it's going to be $3,000 to $5,000. So if you're making $17,000, how are you going to pay $5,000 for a health insurance policy?
Discussion on the A23 amendment.
I'd like a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Walker, actually I'm very sympathetic to what you said about as far as trying to protect. But let me at least do a little bit of review. I remember when I first came here 12 years ago, I watched repeatedly uses of the Healthcare Access Fund for educational programs, for loans, for all kinds of things, really, and wondered what's going on here. And you can look in a fund today and even see, even without movement, you can see that there's been a long history. Now, that doesn't justify it. I mean, as I said, I'm sort of sympathetic to you. But I would also point out, there's a sentence in here on the second page, line 9, that says that it should not be used to replace existing spending on subsidized health care programs. Had we not done that in 2003, we would have had, I think, to have made some fairly significant cuts in medical assistance and or GAMC. And in large measure, we were making some of those shifts. I do believe that it's time to really blend our programs. I think we kid ourselves. We think Minnesota Care is pure. Well, it turns out that through our waivers, most of the people who are on Minnesota Care are actually on medical assistance. Particularly families, children are on it. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. That's kind of nice because we get federal match. But there is such a blending anymore that it's harder and harder to distinguish what specifically is Minnesota Care. And then finally, I'd point out, we already have language that says it's supposed to be for, but every time that something is done, we use what we call the notwithstanding language. And I guess what I would point out, members, I don't know that this language would be anything different than anything we've done in the past, that any legislature in the future that decided to do something would probably use the notwithstanding language. As much as I might be tempted, I'm opposed to it. For part of the reasons I said about the blending, I think that is important to think about in terms of our overall coverage for low-income people, but also because it doesn't accomplish anything more than what we have in current law.
Representative Walker.
Mr. Chair, and thank you for that, Representative Bradley. You know, the culture here, the public sometimes wonders, and we get caught up in. I appreciate you giving your history and you're not understanding why the legislature was doing that when you first came in. And I understand that we've had tough decisions, tough budget situations the last several years, at least since I've been here, except for year one. The last 5 years have been tough. But it doesn't, I don't think, like you said, justify just because they do don't mean we have to do. And being able to be better leaders and making sure that the true intent of the fund is utilized. And if Representative Bradley or staff or council, someone might maybe have to help me here. But if I'm not mistaken, last year we didn't shift the money from Healthcare Access Fund to the GA folks. We actually shifted the GA folks from Minnesota Care. And so it's not quite that simplified as you put it just a moment ago. The shifting went the other way, I believe.
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, actually I wasn't referring to last year. I understand the GAMC switch. I was talking about 2003.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I'll just close. And it's one of those things, I was against it then. And I am okay and proud to be against it now. And I look forward to that wonderful bipartisan support that hopefully I will be getting in just a few moments.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just briefly, I mean, one other thing that, aside from increasing eligibility or expanding eligibility, another thing that I often hear about Minnesota Care and other programs is that they're difficult for providers because we underpay providers. You know, another use of the money in the Health Access Fund could be to actually increase rates that we pay to providers to get them closer to costs. And so I just throw that out for whatever it's worth.
Discussion on the A23 amendment. Seeing no further discussion, the clerk will take the roll.
Bradley?
No.
Hempstead?
No.
Abler?
No.
Dean?
Nope.
Emmer?
No.
Goodwin?
Yes.
Huntley?
Yes.
Hochamba?
Yes.
Pepin?
No.
Powell?
No.
Samuelson?
No.
Thiessen?
Pass.
Walker?
Yes.
Wilkin?
No.
Scene 4, yes, 9, no, and 1, not interested. The amendment, I shouldn't say not interested, not willing to vote. The amendment is not adopted. All right, Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, I believe there's an A27. The author may not need to do that, since I think you took an amendment before that took care of the issue, if I'm correct in that.
Representative Goodwin, that A27 amendment?
Yes, and I appreciate Representative Bradley taking that out of the bill, so we don't need to do that amendment. Thank you again, Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, I believe I hold in my hand the last amendment. And I don't know if it's been distributed. It's the A38 amendment. It's been distributed? Okay. I would move the A38 amendment, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Bradley moves the A38 amendment. Representative Bradley to that amendment.
Okay. Mr. Chair, and members, I want to do the best I can, and maybe Ms. Zimmerman can help me with this. Let's see. About maybe 70 minutes ago, I had a call that an error was discovered. And the error that was discovered was in the sizing of the state-operated services salary supplement. And apparently, thank goodness for this, by the way, because there was an error on the right direction. That is, the expenses for that coverage of that are less than what we had seen in our spreadsheets. To the tune, I believe, of $1.5 million in the current biennium and $2 million in the next biennium. So, although it comes to us late and all those kinds of things, I suppose the good news is that it at least it came to us in the right direction so we can deal with it. And what I'm putting in front of you, members, as a matter of fact, I think actually when I offered the amendment this morning on Medicare Part D and I was sympathetic to the issue, I was taking it from an account that I just could not have, namely the Health Care Access Fund. What I'm doing instead with this amendment is to take it from the general fund, so it would match up to that change that we saw, and actually it puts a little bit more money in as well, but the net would be that it would be $1.5 million in the current biennium, and then a total of $2 million in the next biennium would be allocated to cover the Medicare Part B, the area agency project. So it would replace, and I think this actually works with this amendment. Staff can clarify, because I thought maybe we'd have to reconsider the other amendment, but I think it'll just be in place of the other amendment.
Mr. Chair, members, the A38 amendment would basically replace all of the language in the A37-1 amendment that was adopted. The instruction to, you know, delete the A37-1 amendment isn't on A38, but that perhaps would be part of the motion.
It is sort of implicit in it, but I just would also include in my motion instructions that would delete the A06 1487 amendment that was previously adopted.
Members, everyone got that, so we don't have to do any fancy maneuvers here? All right, Representative Walker to the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Bradley, while I'm not supportive of where the money for this original purpose has to go, I am very supportive of finding other dollars in the general fund, and I will be able to support this.
And you know what? A little luck sometimes doesn't hurt, does it?
You're changing votes, Representative Bradley. All right, members, Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley, you got one phone call that allowed you to do this. Will this take care of the 10 phone calls that I got about senior linkage?
Representative Huntley, I think they patched in our numbers on the senior linkage line. So,
well, Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, I think it probably will. I mean, you know, I told you, I listened very carefully to the testimony. I think it is a very important cause. It's timely. It's not something that we can really put off because it's happening to us right now. So, in that regard, I hope the phone calls will turn to thank yous.
Don't hold your breath. All right, members, any further discussion on the A38 amendment?
No.
See, no discussion. We'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of the A38 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Bradley, to your bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, I believe now I would be renewing my motion that House File 3697 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
All right, members, everyone under...
Oh, I'm sorry, did we... I better withdraw that amendment. There was another piece of action going on here that I forgot about. I apologize. Do we have an amendment now?
Yes.
Has it been distributed?
No, we
haven't. Okay.
We'll take steps back from third reading.
Yeah. I apologize. I forgot about this one. So I had in my hand the second to the last amendment. And I believe now that I have the last amendment. But I'll wait till it gets around to members. Maybe while it's being distributed, I'll explain. Mr. Bangford's here, and if you recall, we had discussed issues about the PCA identifier numbers and some of the concerns about PCA and shared services. An issue that had subsequently come up is about the PCA identifier numbers itself. And the advocate community would like to be sure that if the health plans end up using a number as well, that we would use the same numbers. I hope I've got that right, but if it's around now, Mr. Chair, I would move the A39 amendment.
Representative Bradley moves the A39 amendment. Representative Bradley, do you have any further?
Sorry, Jim.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Bangsberg, Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Home Care Association. The language that you see in front of you is a result of what has happened last year with the major changes that were taken in result of the Personal Care Assistant Program. The Department of Human Services has been installing a brand new personal identification number with all the personal care assistants throughout the state of Minnesota. This has been extremely costly for the home health care agencies to try to put these numbers into action, and they are tied to every single bill and every single invoice that goes out, and they are used in a very judicious manner. We've just been informed that the health plans, literally a week ago, we heard rumors and we heard today of who and what which health plan was going to offer to do a second set of identification numbers. The concern we have here is we're going to have five different identification numbers for one single employee in a home care agency. We don't have the administrative capacity to handle that type of activity with identifiers and dealing with billing for services for personal care assistant programs. That's why this amendment is here before you today. I also want to stress I have had conversations with the health plan companies and the department. They are not in agreement with me, but they did agree to come to the table and allow this amendment to be offered. But they would say that they would allow this to take forward and make it contingent that we work on the resolution of this problem. I don't know if you want any further testimony on this issue.
Captain Bradley.
Mr. Chair, if the health plans would like to be on the record on this, is that sufficient for you?
Yes. And go ahead.
Barsh. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Barsh. I'm here today representing Health Partners. This issue was just brought forward to us today, so I appreciate the attention the committee is giving this in a short period of time. We do understand the difficulty and the administrative burden that having to come up with multiple identifiers by the PCA community and the home health aides, the troubles that can cause them. So, right now, our systems aren't set up to accept the same numbers that are developed by the Department of Human Services for our providers. And so before we would go ahead and require us to accept those same numbers, we've committed to the advocacy community to sit down with them and the Department of Human Services to figure out if we can't find out a solution to this problem in the very near future.
And to share with that good faith agreement, I'll withdraw the amendment.
The amendment has been withdrawn. So you did have the last amendment.
Did have an after all.
All right, the motion before us, members, is that House File 3697 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the Committee on Ways and Means. Members, discussion on that motion. Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, you and the audience all heard our position on use of the Health Care Access Fund and how we think that it ought to be used as slowly for what it was intended, which was to provide a subsidized sliding fee help on working people's health insurance. So I won't get into a long discussion about that, but just one other item, and that's the Veterans Home Board. I happen to have their past chair in my district, and they're very concerned about having to close two veterans homes, and presumably it'd be the one in Silver Bay and the one in Hastings. the money they requested is things they're already doing. Okay, when they had the problem they had, they started doing these things, and if we don't fund them, they're going to have to stop doing those things. And the way that the only way they can balance that budget is to close several of their veterans nursing homes. So I'm very concerned about that. Hopefully we can find some additional money in the conference committee.
Members, any further discussion? Any further discussion? Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I certainly respect Representative Huntley's statement, particularly on the Veterans Home funding, and I feel bad about that myself. It's simply a matter of how much money is available, and I'm hopeful that we can do something about that additionally in the Conference Committee. The Healthcare Access Fund discussion, we've aired that. I don't need to add anything to that. But I would remind members, however, that there's also a lot of things in here that we should focus on and are very positive. We are funding the protection of our citizens by handling the increased growth in state-operated services for mentally ill and dangerous, for sexual predators. We're handling the salary supplement. We have, I think, historic reforms in the assisted living field, and we spent a lot of time refining that. And I think there's a lot of areas in here. In a non-budget year, I think we've fulfilled as much obligation as we can in a supplemental budget. And I do appreciate, I think we've had some excellent discussion, even if we differed sometimes. I think we've really had some excellent discussion here in this committee, and I appreciate that discussion. And at this point, I would simply renew my motion.
That's good.
Yes, we have a question. I just have dying to find out how much additional money is in here for, and maybe you know this, maybe the department has to answer, for Health Match and Maxis and MMIS, because I just heard that Health Match has again gone up additional millions of dollars, and it has again extended the date when it's going to be done. So I'm sure buried in here somewhere, not in a line item, certainly, like it should be, but would like to know that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, to the best of my full ability, I am not putting more money into Health Match. We do have a couple of places of workarounds. You notice we took the Representative Avery proposal and took the multi-million-dollar effect that had it been Health Match and dropped it down to like $150,000 or something like that. So I've been very watchful. I'm just as hawkish maybe as you are on that issue.
And the other one, Mr.
Representative Goodwin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley, I saw new that there were there's still 800 extra positions for St. Peter, and I don't know if it was only for St. Peter, but it looked like the language says 800 additional staff positions. The amount of money that's going to St. Peter is, I averaged out per additional patient or whatever you want to call sexual predator, that I'd want to call them other things, but to be about, it's to average out to be about close to $250,000 per person that's going to be spent, and I think that's a lot of money, and I'm wondering how that all works out, that the amount of money that's going to St. Peter in the 800 positions, those two things I'm really curious about.
Yeah. Representative Bradley.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Goodman, to be perfectly honest, I don't recall the staff numbers. It would be a little surprising. I mean, most of that was actually Moose Lake is where most of the growth is going to be, but St. Peter probably has some of the, at least for a while, the mentally ill and dangerous. I don't remember the 800 staff, sorry.
On the it's in the bill on the last page, unless that was changed somewhere within an amendment. But I thought it was the last page. Maybe Mr. Chun, but I thought it was the last page. Maybe Mr. Chun can tell us for sure. Might be on the wrong spot here, but I know it's at 800 new because it kind of made my eyes pop out. And I'm big on staff rather than consultants, by the way, but I still thought that was a lot of
Jefferson Goodwin, are you looking at, can you give us a specific page you're looking at?
You know. I can't. But I saw it, read it in here yesterday. Does anybody, any of the research staff know? Nobody knows?
In the budget book.
Oh, gee, maybe I dreamt it.
In the budget book, there's...
Representative Thiessen?
Well, in the budget book, in the budget book, at least for the sex offender program, FTE growth is 123 in 2006 to 245 in 2009. And I don't know if there is for some of the other programs as well. But wherever that's
maybe, but I know I thought it was in the bill. But at any rate, I can save that for. I mean, I can talk to you about that after this meeting and so forth. But I just would like information from the department about how many staff positions and how much funding is going towards consultants or contracts or whatever, and how many staff positions and what the money is being appropriated for St. Peter and Moose Lake. And how much that amounts to per client. I know we ask these questions. The department has been fairly good at giving us answers, but there's a lot of times I have not received answers, so I really hope to know what that is. Thank you. I'm done.
Thank you, Representative Goodwin. Members, any further discussion? See no further discussion. We'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of House File 3697, being recommended to pass, may refer to the Committee on Ways and Means, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No. Mr. Chair.
The motion is adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we're about to close up the committee, I listening to Representative Goodwin, and I just wanted to thank you because a year wouldn't have went by if you wouldn't have brought up the consultant and... It just wouldn't have been right. While I have the floor, I also just wanted to take a moment to thank Representative Goodwin for joining us on the Health Committee with your wit and passion. You definitely, we came in together, you definitely will be missed. Wanted to thank Chair Bradley for the learning experience and the wonderful debate. I wish I could say some of it. Some of it won't be missed. But some of it will be missed because I always like to be challenged on not only how I personally believe, but also being able to advocate for the individuals that I do represent. And I just wanted to say that since we're about to close, you guys have been gems. Thanks.
Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, there's a... one of us that won't be here next year. And Chairman Bradley, I think, has done a really good job of running this committee, and he's been fair, he's been honest, sometimes open. And he's never tried to, you know, hide things and surprise us. And everything that he's ever said to me in these 12 years now? Has been straightforward and honest. So I appreciate his service to the state, and I think we all ought to give him a round of applause.
Representative Bradley, you're not going to get off that easy, though. We have put together a little array of gifts for you. And I just want to point out a couple things. You've been a member for 12 years, chair for 8 years. And it didn't really strike me until this morning about why you worked so hard the last few years for long term.
Wasn't there a motion to adjourn?
There has not been a motion to adjourn. See, this is good. I have to have a hell of a...
The age is already
there. Yeah. Well, it didn't come to me until this morning when you were, again, talking about long-term care issues. And I realized you're getting close to retirement. You have to worry about those things.
Most gladly.
All right. So, at this point, Representative Bradley, I'm going to call on Representative Wilkin. He has something he'd like to say.
Representative Bradley, I understand you're going to go on a little trip here to Florida, and we've got a few gifts here for you. You got some flip-flops there. We got some very attractive sunglasses. I think those are just your size, so we're going to want you to try those on.
It's a model now.
Hey, who said that?
But maybe later. But we will get you with them on. But, you know, some of us would say that you started your vacation about 12 years ago. But we appreciate very much your thoughtful leadership and involving us all in the committee. You've done great and been great to learn from. So thank you.
Thank you much.
Representative Abler, you have something?
Yeah, actually, I'm going to go over
here. That's a green bucket.
You know, you want to dance on the beach, and you want to have a couple margaritas. You couldn't have actually alcohol kept against house rules now. So, I don't know if anybody's refrigerator, but that's a different discussion. You know, we have he's kind of a workaholic. I don't have to realize that. But, here to help. Anyway, just on the beach, you can take notes about things you take notes
about. Aw, isn't that
cute? A little softboard. And after you have a couple of these, actually, you might actually vote for something that the team this
later.
All right, now it's my turn. You were elected 12 years ago, and I just want to give you a little look into my life. I graduated high school 12 years ago. So.
That's better than the line that you laid on the board one.
That's right. So I have a bucket here for you, a calculator, because everyone knows how you like your spreadsheets and how you stickler for the numbers. Notice they're large keys, so and in case you have problems in the future, seeing that we're a magnifying glass here also. So I'll ask someone to bring that up. But again, just thank you for your leadership and everything that we've all been able to learn and get from you. You've just been a great friend, so we can't thank you enough. Representative Fowler will try to thank you more, though.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Fran, during your 12 years here, you've done a lot of heavy lifting, and I'm sure you've had a lot of aches and pains. And, in fact, I'm sure you've caused a lot of people aches. I have some things for the aches and pains. We have a pain relief patch and a bottle of aspirin and a pill organizer. That's exactly. Mr. Chairman, thank you for all you've done for me. The growth I've been able to have in my short time here has been largely because of your mentorship, and I deeply appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bradley, we can't hear about your retirement without also hearing about your grandkids and about how excited you are to see the grandkids. So we've got some grandkid items here. We've got some dishes, and we've got some baby food here for you. We got the Gerber baby food going on. we've also got a little bib for the grandkids, and then as time goes on, the grandkids can reciprocate, and you know, you can wear the bib, the baby food from the dish. But we've just got that ready for you. But seriously, thank you, Fran, for all that you've done for me and for the group. This is a very difficult committee to get into, and as a freshman, just kind of learning everything, there's a very steep learning curve anywhere you go, but particularly with this committee. And you have been nothing but an excellent mentor, and particularly for us new folks, giving us unbelievable opportunities. So I want to thank you for that. And also, for the work that you have done on behalf of the disabled community. Every time an advocate comes in my office and points out the things that I've done, I've always said, thank Fran Bradley, and I will continue to do that as long as I'm here. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Samuelson.
Okay, I think you like to drive a motorcycle, right?
Yeah.
And that's going to be one of the things that you'll be
doing. A Harley in there?
I have got it in here.
Oh, my God.
Yes, no, it's a chopper. But, you know, with your motorcycle, you need somebody on the back, right? To ride with you. We got Harvey.
You don't know, my wife won't ride with me.
Barbie biker babe.
Barbie biker babe. It's lovely. You know, you can plant a lot of flowers in here.
Yeah.
Because they don't have any handles on them. But anyway, thank you for everything and for all the interest that you've taken in long-term care over the years.
Thank you, Char. Thank you. It's very kind.
Well, the kindness will end. Representative Ember.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to reconsider.
This is dead serious, Chairman. I hope you've learned something from me in your last 2 years.
Would you care to remind me?
Actually, I figure I'm going to have plenty of time to say thank you over the next few weeks, so I'm going to reserve that for later. I think everybody is very grateful for everything you've done for the state and for the folks that are in this room, in the constituencies that you've served. I'm going to have a little fun with you, thanks to the folks that are here. Representative Wilkins said it to begin with, that you've pretty much been on vacation, and I know from coming from a house where I've got somebody at home taking care of business while I'm here doing this so difficult job, how hard this has been for you. But now you're going to get to go home and do the real job. So I understand you're going to be cleaning some toilets. So we've got this is a user-friendly. This should be good for your wrists. And we have given you some disposable gloves as well. If you have some allergy to latex, we can return them for you. Now, if you don't do it and you end up in the doghouse, we've got some bones for you. And frankly, I know how much you're probably going to miss Barb, so we're going to give you these to chew on. And actually, there's two, so if you'd like to share with Barb on your way out, you'll both have something to chew on rather than each other. Now, if you do end up in the doghouse, and this is a family show, so if anybody needs to leave, now's the time. we have an outfit here. Okay? I'm too sexy for these boxers or whatever this says. And then just in case anybody's confused.
I guarantee you my wife won't believe that.
All I can say to you, sir, is I didn't buy these. No, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Representative Pepin.
Well, Representative Bradley, I know you're going to miss this place. And I'm imagining you're probably going to go back to Rochester and probably watch committee every chance you get. And I'm guessing you'll watch Thor's session as well. And if ever a time should come when you get a little frustrated, you think we're going in the wrong direction, you're upset with something someone says, we've got a handy little game of pin the tail on the donkey that you can stick that right on the TV, and that'll help you get your frustrations out. I hope that helps.
On a more serious note, Representative Bradley, I was a staff person here when you were elected in 1994, and you were a mentor to me even back then, and I thank you for your great leadership on the committee, and I do have the one serious gift. Well, it's kind of serious, but since you won't be doing, hopefully, you won't be reading, putting together omnibus bills and reading bills at midnight on a Friday or Saturday, we have a book for you, and it's Your Best Life Now, 90 Devotions. So we hope you enjoy your retirement, and we'll be thinking of you often.
Thank you.
All right. Any further comments? Preston Bradley, do you want to come and take the gavel?
I can do it from here. I don't know if I do it because I'm like a... I'll from here. Okay. Thank you, even for the fun, and that's part of, I think, something we don't get enough of, frankly, is to have fun, to be able to laugh together. And even if it's at my expense, that's okay, because it's fun. You know, there's a lot of thoughts that run through the mind as people are saying all these things, and I'm not going to get kind of crazy. I what I would say is this. I've always believed, frankly, that we succeed, that there's power in the intellect of groups, of people working together, of debating, discussing things. And I've never felt so full that it's just about me, you know. And I'm not saying that I haven't made mistakes along the way. I've learned along the way, too. And it's been just an incredible experience. I could tell my grandkids, but they're already in the age. Maybe I can even tell my great-grandkids someday that I've had the honor and the privilege of serving in this great institution, of looking out my window and seeing that terrific dome, of sitting in the House chambers. And it still, after 12 years, sends little prickles up my spine, because it really is an awesome experience. And it's been an awesome experience to be part of this team, because in some ways, I think we are a team. We all, I think, have the same kind of objective. We may differ in process of getting there, but I always respect that every one of us wants to do what's right for Minnesota, what's right for our constituents. And I take a lot of good meaning in that, and I know that things will continue. As there have been a lot of thank yous, because it would be easy for us members to think we do it all, although we know better, actually. If you don't mind, I would like to take a moment to recognize the true heroes. I mean, we talk about work ethic and being here. Usually when we're leaving, these are the people who are still here working through this past weekend, you can imagine. So I'm going to probably take a little bit of a risk, but first of all, I just want to, if I can remember everybody here, but to acknowledge our great staff. And let me begin with Ben Steiner, who I think I told everybody is going to be one of our doctors one of these days. So be nice to him. Ben, thank you for what you've done. And each of our caucuses have wonderful people. I think the dean of Partisan Caucus, I think I've been around Dave Greenman so many years that even before I was here, but I really respect his participation and his leadership in his own caucus. And Elaine Fair may be newer, although not so much new to the caucus, but to our caucus staff, thank you so much for what you've given. And I've said this for years, I think we have just unbelievable, and these are people, because they're way up there on the seventh floor or wherever it is, we don't necessarily see them for all the work that they do. Is it seventh or sixth? It better be sixth. I created a new floor. The sixth floor. But our incredible research staff, again, they're kind of the senior fellow, is Randy Chun. But also Danielle Meyer, Lynn Ays, and Janelle Taylor. To that great team, thank you to you. New on board, but took charge right away. Even when you discover only 15 minutes before the committee's going to start, and I call her in desperation and say, could you fix this? And immediately I get a fix. Marie Zimmerman has been just terrific as our fiscal analyst. Marie, thank you. Now, these next two people are very close. Now, I'm the luckiest person in the world from a legislative assistant. There are people around who've had, in a short experience, 8, 10 or so different legislative assistants. Cheryl Burke and I have been together as a team since I started here. It just doesn't happen. But I tell you, Cheryl, you are the greatest. Thank you. And then the hardest worker of the hardest workers of the hardest workers of the hardest workers. I would feel guilty about the times of day that I've had contact with Susie to say, could you do this, could you do that, except that I shouldn't feel too guilty, because the times of day she contacts me are any time as well. But the commitment, and I know this is not partisan really, because I think that people on both sides of the aisle know how really, really hard Susie Giroux works and what a terrific committee administrator is. Susie, thank you. Thank you very much. Well, I'd like to say I'll miss you every day, but I won't. Right, bud?
Right.
And if you see Barb and I out there chewing on our bones together.
Exactly.
Well, again, we've completed at least one big step of our work for this year. Thank you to all of you who participate, and thank you, by the way, for the extension of the team, because the people in this room also are part of our team. Thank you so much to you. I believe with that, Mr. Chair, I'll do my final. We're adjourned.